Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, acclaimed journalist Randall Sullivan talks about writing baseball and his new book, The First All-Star Game, Babe Ruth, FDR, and America at the Crossroads. He is interviewed by comedian Joe Kilgallen. This program took place at the 2026 American Writers Festival. Co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library, the American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 6, 2026, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good afternoon. Welcome. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the AWM. I'd like to welcome you all to our ongoing American Writers Festival and just offer a few housekeeping notes before our next program. Admission to the museum and to the festival is free this weekend, but if you feel moved to do so, our staff will happily assist you in making a donation near the front desk in support of our activities. Our next program is about one of the city's favorite subjects, sometimes, baseball. In the pivotal summer of 1933, right here in Chicago, national crisis and a sports fight for survival converged in baseball's first All-Star game. Here to tell us the story of that game and its place in sports and national history is Randall Sullivan, contributing editor to Rolling Stone for over 20 years. He's the author of Graveyard of the Pacific, Dead Wrong, The Price of Experience, Labyrinth, The Miracle Detective, and Untouchable. His work has been published in, among many other places, Wired, Esquire, Men's Journal, Washington Post, and The Guardian. He'll be interviewed by writer, comedian, and TV producer Joe Kilgallen. Please join me in welcoming them to the AWM.
Thank you, Allison. How's everyone doing? We great? Wonderful. This is very exciting for me, not just as a very, very massive baseball fan, but as a proud Chicagoan. So thank you so much for writing this book, Randall Sullivan. The Cubs had a player named Randall Simon, so in my brain I had to keep yelling, don't call him Randall Simon, don't call him Randall Simon.
Please don't.
So everyone, what's so wonderful about reading this book was I was meeting a friend for lunch, and I had my copy on the, you know, typical diner. I was in the booth. And I was telling my friend about how much I was enjoying it. I was only halfway through at this point. And she was like, baseball, not really my thing. I go, it is so much more than just a book about baseball. It starts off with FDR and Cermak and the assassination attempt on FDR that did take out Chicago's mayor, Cermak. So I just thought to myself, what was the exact moment where you thought, I need to write a book about this game and the importance of this game, with the background of the Depression looming and America baseball being at a crossroads?
Well, I only have a long answer to that.
Go for it then. Makes my job easier.
You know, I was really depleted after writing my book, The Devil's Best Trick, which is a very dark and scary book. So I was really looking for something that would, you know, offer a lighter path. But I was also feeling really depressed about the state of the country, and I was kind of preoccupied with the level of polarization, and it feels like we're coming apart. And I thought, but this country survived apocalypses before. And I started reading about the Great Depression, and I realized that it had bottomed out, and the country had really started to tick back up in the late spring and early summer of 1933. So what happened then? Some of it was Roosevelt, the new president, Roosevelt's policies. But the two, you know, biggest events nationally were the Chicago World's Fair and this baseball game that was played as an exhibition as part of the fair. And you could sort of see that however degree it did this, that it was sort of part of triggering this kind of upward surge in self-belief and resiliency in the country, so it sounded like something that might be pretty uplifting to write about.
I felt uplifted after having read it. I felt, you know, a lot of Americans are feeling the same way with everything that's going on, that it was kind of nice to be able to read about a time in America where FDR was ushering this era of hope. You know, the stock market had crashed just a few years earlier, And with baseball being such a big part of the culture at the time, the America's pastime, the fact that they brought in a new commissioner who was a judge, Kennison Mountain Landis. Is there a better name, by the way? Kennison Mountain Landis, like perfect name to kind of bring purity back to the game. Because a lot of people after the Chicago Black Sox scandal of 1919 were falling, could we trust the game of baseball?
Yeah.
I also want to, I know this isn't a question really, but I want to give you a lot of credit because we're in an era in which things don't age very well. Your books have aged incredibly well. You were writing about the Billionaires Boys Club long before it became at the forefront of what everyone's been talking about. Michael Jackson movie's out. You read a wonderful book about that. So I got to imagine you take great pride in the fact that the things, the subjects you're choosing are lasting long into, you know, the American conscious.
Well, I'm one writer who is a big thanks to movies and television because they've provided most of my income as an adult and are keeping my work alive. But thank you.
Yes, right. So basically, I think my question there was going to be about, did your publisher think you're going to baseball now? You'd written about detectives, police corruption, billionaires, the price of power.
I just finished a book about the devil.
Yes, that. There we go. And here we go to the lighthearted subject of baseball. So you grew up as an athlete. I believe you were quite the jock in high school.
Well, I was jockish. I did, in those days, football, basketball, baseball was all we had. So I played football, basketball, baseball, all through school. Only ever really won a trophy as a high school player in football. But I loved baseball, too. I played it every summer from 7 to 17.
So it naturally made a lot of sense. Baseball's tie with history and everything that overlaps with it. Is there anything in particular while you were doing your research where you thought, okay, this is the one thing that I cannot wait to tell my friends about that I discovered? I hope this is the one nugget that people really take away from this book.
Well, I started with, I thought, what's the most interesting thing, which is that an attempted assassination of Franklin Roosevelt actually triggered the series of events that led to the All-Star Game. So I figured if I don't have you hooked with that first sentence, this probably isn't the book for you.
And you did. So many people, I don't think, even realize the backstory of why the assassination attempt. It's kind of funny to me. It took place in Miami, and the man thought FDR was this huge capitalist.
Yeah.
He was a socialist and wanted to take down American capitalists. Little did he know that he almost killed the man who, in a lot of ways, brought about social democracy to the United States of America.
Yeah, well, he simply saw him as a figurehead of American leadership. I mean, he was crazy, but passionately and inspired kind of crazy, dangerous kind of crazy.
And thankfully for FDR, a bad shot. Not so much for Mayor Cermak.
Yeah. He fired off 5 shots and hit 6 people. Not one of them was Roosevelt.
Yeah. Shows us the danger of guns there when you're not even your intended target. So also, I love the journalism that went behind this. It really feels like you left no stone unturned in which finding out every little thing. Is there any advice you'd give to any young nonfiction writers on where to start and how to do your due diligence with a subject matter that, yes, the All-Star Game is part of it, but there's so much around it that leads to why this game was so important?
Well, first, really be interested in the subject.
There you go.
If you're not, passion.
If
you're not, you won't be able to sustain it. We have advantage. I mean, I wrote my first book on a typewriter. I didn't get a computer until, I was well into my career, and it was the computers we had then were nothing, and there was no internet. So the realization, I mean, what you deal with today, especially baseball, has been so well documented. So many great historians, and it's all online. So it's just a matter of like asking the computer smart questions, making these associations, these connections, and you will see that it is stored somewhere. And usually you can find it digitally. Occasionally you have to actually go somewhere to see a document. But almost everything is online. And I really, owe tremendous thanks to the legions of amateur baseball historians who have created, it seems like, zillions of bytes of this information. You can, type in, a game that was played in 1927 between these two teams, such and such a day, and it comes up immediately. Not just the box score, but, a significant amount of information about the book. I mean, about the game.
Of course. Yeah, it's one of the things that is really thrilling being a baseball fan, especially a Chicago baseball fan. One of the things I do on the side is I'm a Wrigley Field tour guide. And the pre-internet age, I think, is what makes things so interesting in regards to the history of baseball with America and the city of Chicago. I mean, if you want a book that talks about the Untouchables and Al Capone and that early Democratic machine, the vote early, vote often part of Chicago's
pineapple
politics.
Pineapple primary.
Yeah, there we go.
You know, really, nothing you said made me feel better than that you really love the Chicago history and you didn't know a lot of it, because you know a lot of Chicago history.
I didn't. There were parts of it where I was baffled for whatever reason, because Cermak is such a, you know, it's a big street in Chicago named after Cermak, and I always thought he was one of those mayors who'd been around for a long time, and he really wasn't.
No.
Yeah, and the way he had grew, I really hope that so many people not only read this book and recommend it to all of their friends, because it brought pride in Chicago. It reminded me of why, I'm not sure if you know, right now a lot of Chicagoans are upset because the latest news about the Chicago Bears moving, you're nodding your head, moving to Northwest Indiana.
I just read that, yeah. It's shocking, but it's like the New York Giants moving to New Jersey now, you know, but at least the Chicago seemed like they'd never give up their team.
No, that's the thing about Chicago. Reading your book and then thinking about everything that's going on right now, it reminded me of Chicagoans have a pride. We try to act like it's all sorts of other things, like it's our culture, it's the way we brought in other cultures, the architecture. It's that we're cool. We're a cool city. That's what it comes down to, right? Having Chicago Bears is cool.
Yeah,
Northwest Indiana is not cool. Reading this book reminded me of how cool Chicago is, even with the corruption. There's just some parts.
It was colorful corruption.
It is. It's entertaining corruption. There are so many little aspects about this city, and I'm really glad that you highlighted that. And that's another funny thing about the city of Chicago is we tend to celebrate things that maybe we shouldn't celebrate. Did you land at O'Hare by chance?
I flew in through.
Of course. I don't know if Midway has this, but O'Hare Airport has a store in which they have Al Capone T-shirts. We forget this man was a criminal. So, yes, you did a wonderful job with that. And I as a Chicagoan, I thank you. And do you have, like, a love for the city before? And I'm sure you've come through here many a times.
Well, I spent a lot of time here in the 1980s. You know, I was hoping you were going to ask me when was the last time you were in Chicago, because I have a good answer.
Oh, well, that's what I asked you. That's exactly what I did.
It's when Oprah flew me here to be on her show when she still had a show here.
Oprah? Who is this Oprah you speak of?
I have to tell you this story. The first time I was in Chicago was the summer of 1976, and my then girlfriend and I were driving a Volkswagen Beetle with our backpacks on top, both, you know, hippies from the West Coast, and the spectacle we created when we drove onto the Loop, I wasn't prepared for it. People were stopping and staring and cheering and, you know, like, look, this is incredible. There's actual hippies. You know?
It's like, they were happy to see the real deal. That's wonderful. So, and tell us about Oprah. I mean, you gave us a little tease. Oprah's still a big heralded Chicagoan, grew up in Mississippi, but she's ours. We claim her.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I can't say I know how devoted she is to the city. She was then. I mean, you know, she gave me a TV show, so I have to appreciate that. But then, you know, she threatened to sue me if I did anything else, and so I'm, you know, I've got mixed feelings.
Yeah, I could totally understand that. So, in regards to the history of the book and everything coming together with the All-Star Game, Babe Ruth, the called shot was at Wrigley Field in October 1st, 1932's Game 3 of the World Series between the Cubs and Yankees. As a Wrigley Field tour guide, we often talk about that. It's considered the most iconic home run hit in baseball history. Now, there's a lot of debates whether he was pointing at the pitcher, Charlie Root, or if he was pointing out to center field. I had no idea that president-elect at the time, or not even president-elect, it was a month before the election, was in the crowd and was trying to not cheer too hard for his Yankees.
He threw out the ball.
He threw out the first pitch.
Yeah. He was sitting with Cermak.
Sitting with Cermak. That's when their friendship began.
Yeah, it did. I mean, you know, the backstory is pretty colorful, because Cermak went to Miami to see Roosevelt because he was trying to get out of, he needed to be out of Chicago because there was a trial of Frank Nitti, who'd taken over from Capone running the mob. and there were going to be police officers testifying that Cermak had ordered them to put a hit on Nitti so that this other gangster could take over his territory. So you can imagine the Chicago journalists were waiting anxiously for Cermak to come back home and answer those questions, which he avoided by getting shot and dying in a Miami hospital.
That's all within the first 25 pages, everyone. I cannot believe how quickly I was like, yes, yes, thank you. Because, you know, I was glad to do this, but I thought it was going to be more about, like a lot of people, like we talked about that a little bit backstage. Many people think, oh, it's the All-Star game. It's going to be right up there with baseball nerds, which I consider myself. I've read so many sabermetrics books and about the history of the game, potential future of the game. To hear the Chicago history interweaved like that, fingers crossed for a Netflix series, because this would be a great limited series on any streaming service or network, because just that alone, the guy is dodging Chicago because there's potential he's going to end up in jail, instead avoids it by being assassinated. I mean,
yeah, I've had a couple of producers, you know, approach to talk about it, and the question I always have is, who could play Babe Ruth?
That's a tough one. You might have to go like the movie Air. They decided not to have anyone play Michael Jordan because some people are just larger than life.
Yeah.
Well, if they do get anyone to play the Babe, let's not go, as much as I love John Goodman as an actor.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Has anyone ever seen the movie The Babe that came out in the early 90s? Not the pig one. Good movie, though, that one. Same actor, the guy who plays pigs, the Babe, the pig's farmer, was the man who was the priest in the early movie part of the movie The Babe. Anyhow, John Goodman, who's a great actor, looked like he never had swung a baseball bat before in his life. That would be a tough one. Who could play the Babe? Well, we'll figure it out. We'll figure that out. That's the next project. Now, I love your journalism background, and it's evident with all of your nonfiction work. It really is the details. And again, going from talking about Suge Knight with the Biggie and Tupac murders to Michael Jackson and everything that went on there to now this book that just really comes across with America. What advice would you have that you wish you knew when you got into the subject of nonfiction that you would like to tell any aspiring writers?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, you know, you have to believe the truth matters, you know, first and foremost. And that, you know, I started off as a fiction writer. I won a fiction writing fellowship at Columbia. My first book was a collection of short stories. But I just discovered that my greatest talent and ultimately my deepest interest was in the truth. I think we often think, because the truth doesn't fit neatly, it isn't a obvious narrative, but there usually is a clear narrative. It's really having the patience and the insight, you know, to pull that out. There is a story there. I mean, there is a coherent story there. So, you know, believe that and stick with telling that story.
I love that. It was a big question, but you gave it a big answer, and I love that. You touched on something in that with the truth. You know, sadly, with modern times, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, fake news and this and that.
Post-truth reality.
Yes, you know, the old expression, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story and all that. As a journalist, is there anything in particular that you would like to say that you find, I guess I'll be a little blunt with it, the upsetting about modern journalism?
Well, they know what they're going to write before they write it, and it kind of destroys the whole pleasure of it. I mean, for me, the discovery is what drives me to do it. I can't write a book without a sense of discovery, you know, that, and it's leading me to whatever the story is. Sometimes it's not a story you really want to tell, like with Labyrinth, which involved the murders of Tupac and Biggie. It didn't exactly fit into the, you know, the politically advantaged narrative. I felt the truth mattered and the people deserved to hear it. And, you know, when Biggie's mother told me that she really appreciated and respected I told the truth, even though it was painful for a lot of people. That's, you know, but people ultimately would rather have the truth than, you know, some, I don't know, you know, contrived or calculated reduction of it.
You're right, the investigation aspect of it, the sense of discovery, which was going to lead to my next question for you about when you write a book, does the joy come from the research?
It comes from the sense of discovery. I mean, I love the writing as much. Of course, like most writers, I love having written even more. But yeah. Like, this book is really probably a better example of any of becoming, I really started to care about these guys, the players in particular. You know, I felt, you know, I think it's something, has something to do with getting older and feeling that I want to honor the past and the people who came before me and the people whose shoulders we're all standing on and memorialize them. And these great players have been sort of forgotten. I mean, Babe Ruth is remembered, although he is actually even bigger than we all think. I mean, he was the most enormous figure in American sports at his time ever. I mean, people try to compare Michael Jordan, and I understand them in Chicago. When Babe Ruth was out with a illness, attendance at American League games dropped by 34%. If Michael Jordan was out with an injury, it wouldn't drop 3.4% for NBA games.
That's very true.
That's how big Babe Ruth was.
So Babe Ruth is the Michael Jordan of early baseball superstars. I always love that about Michael Jordan, is people will say, this person's the Michael Jordan of that. That's how big Michael Jordan was. But you're right, Babe Ruth. That's the thing, too. This book, I hate to keep using the word crossroads, although it is on the cover, is that you have so many major figures throughout American history that carried over into pop culture. Babe Ruth, Al Capone. I mean, FDR, of course, not just as a president, but as what he stood for.
Well, I think that really was compelling for me to write about, because you sort of know, but the realization that all this was going on at the same time, that Roosevelt became president about 2 weeks apart from when Hitler became chancellor of Germany, and that Babe Ruth was sharing headlines with Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd and Charles Lindbergh, Charlie Chaplin. That was all, those were the other celebrities of his time. And it really gave me a feeling for the ferment of the time. And also the Depression. I mean, America, we also have forgotten how bad it was. I mean, it was so bad that America started giving up on itself. And the fact that somehow the country was able to regather itself and start coming back, to me, was really uplifting, because we will do that again.
And I believe that what you just said there, those last couple sentences, would be the biggest two sentences I would use to recommend this book to any friend of mine, whether they're a fiction or nonfiction fan, was the sense of hope, the sense that if we dug ourselves out of that hole, we could dig ourselves out of further holes. And there is a sense of American resiliency that this book really, emphasizes and kind of gives you hope as you turn the pages. And every other part of the book, too, is just another, like, wow. So you wanted to highlight those players that have been forgotten. Was there a certain player through your research where you're like, this is someone I'd want to be friends with?
Boy, it's hard to narrow it down to one. I mean, Mickey Cochrane, because he suffered so much during the Depression. Chuck Klein, because he was so neglected afterward. Chicago, the White Sox own Al Simmons, who was one of the greatest players. He was the biggest vote getter in that first All-Star game. He was the only one who got more votes than Babe Ruth, and who knows Al Simmons anymore?
It's very true. Also, it was a Chicago vote, so who could trust it back then? So
yeah.
That's another thing. Chicago is such a main character of this book, and we talked about that backstage where you felt like, I don't think you set out for that, though, correct? You didn't really set out to make Chicago.
No. Honestly, I did. I mean, I knew the game was played in Chicago. I didn't know this Chicago history. So once I got into it, I mean, I only knew it vaguely, but once I got into it and I realized how it all connected, and all of the, it was like in terms of this book, I didn't have to fake it or make it. Chicago was the center of the world in the spring and summer of 1933.
The World's Fair was coming up in 1933.
It was the biggest event on the planet at the time.
It really was. And talking about the previous one that we had in 1893, with the White City, which was massive at the time as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were trying to, rephrase that. But the first one was basically helping people see that Chicago was more than the Great Fire. in 1933, they were trying to make people see that Chicago was more than crime and corruption. That, you know.
I don't know if they did that great a job of it, to be honest with you. It was one of those things where I feel like every Chicago kid, I was born and raised in the city, and I remember my dad showing movie Stripes with Bill Murray, maybe a little too young, I feel like, looking back, he showed me that movie. But there's a scene where they're crossing over to what was Czechoslovakia at the time, and they, American, they go, ooh, Chicago, bang, bang. Like, that was what they said, that was written, because that was the world's view of the city of Chicago at the time. Yeah. And what's frustrating to a lot of Chicagoans now, I was thinking about that when I was walking into the building. Right now we have a Pokemon Go festival happening. I don't know if you notice, several of them, they're looking on their phones walking into people because they're trying to find the Pokemon. We've got this great American Writers Festival happening. There is a soccer match going on down the street in a little bit. So all of this happening, and all I do is look around and see people enjoying this great city of ours and reminding me how cool it is. And so as a diehard Chicagoan, I really want to thank you for also emphasizing and really showcasing this city's amazingly wild history. It really is. And it's hopefully just keeps going in that regard. So selfishly, I've got to ask, when will your next book about Chicago be? Soon?
Yeah.
We're hoping very soon.
You know, I don't know when my next book will be. I mean, I've started two and abandoned them. And it's the longest I've gone without being immersed in a new book. I've had some TV and movie stuff that has given me an excuse not to be writing a new book. But, you know, what I can say is about that Chicago is that, you know, Chicago gets appreciated when people come there. You know, I've spent my whole adult life in publishing and the entertainment industries, New York and LA. That's where I've lived when I wasn't living in my native Oregon. And people in New York and L.A. tend to forget about Chicago almost, but then they come here and people always tell me how blown away they are by the fact that that's a really great city. That's one of the great cities on the planet, you know, but people don't get it really until they come here, you know. I mean, they imagine themselves at Wrigley Field maybe, or, you know, but you know, and I'm guilty myself. I didn't really appreciate Chicago's magnificence until I came to spend time here.
Thank you. I'll take credit for all of that. I am an ambassador of the city of Chicago. You know, you're right, though. That is true. And as Chicagoans, some of us like it. It's like we're on a little secret, you know, that we gatekeep a little bit. I'm sure some of us do. And then the rest of us, we want people to know this is truly a great city. It's we've got Ferris Bueller's Day Off. You know what I mean? We had, which actually was 42 years ago yesterday, I think, was the anniversary of that. Why are you shaking your head?
Don't remind us.
Oh, no, how long ago it was? It does feel like it was just yesterday. Yes, we are a great city on a lake. And one of my favorite things is when people visit it, they are shocked. They are, like you said it, people are very surprised with how amazing this city truly is. That's one of the funnier things to me. The second funniest thing is that people see our lake and they go, that's not a lake, that's an ocean. That's not lakes, you're supposed to see the other side too. They're always baffled. But I tell them it's a pretty great lake in that regard.
Well, I will tell you that, you know, I've had, because of what I've been doing lately, I have had a number of conversations with movie and television people, and somehow I've mentioned that every time I mention I'm going to Chicago, oh, I love Chicago, you know. So, you know, it does get love from people who know it.
Who have been there, yes. I think Chicago's only gotten a really bad rep lately because it was just a way for, not to get political, but for one political party to hit the other one. You know, associate Chicago with, you know, these people are bad, the Chicago this, the Chicago that of things, which is really a way to make President Obama look bad. I think that's where it all began.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to weigh in on that, I'm not going to argue against it.
There you go. Yeah, not going to weigh in, not going to argue against either. That's a really great backdrop there. So if while doing the research of this book and the FDR's significance in everything in regards to that, do you believe that if this game doesn't happen as like a big cultural event at the beginning of his term, does that inspire Americans' confidence in him going forward?
It helped.
It helped.
It added to it. I think it inspired Americans' confidence in America and in baseball. And it sort of is a story. I mean, it's easy to forget how essential baseball was and is to American history, you know, the fiber of the national spirit. It was the game in 1933. It was 10 times bigger than football and basketball combined. So it was really part of the essence of the country. But it was in bad shape, too. You know, that people couldn't afford tickets. All of the teams were losing money. Some were, you know, wondering if they could, you know, stay together. The minor leagues lost two-thirds of minor leagues disappeared during the Depression. So it wasn't simply the game. There were other things, and they were decisions that the Roosevelt administration made. But somehow it did connect to this sense in America that, you know, we can still, and the fair, the Chicago Four World's Fair did that too. We can still do great things. It was kind of a story of how good it feels when everything comes together.
That is 100. That's the big thing. I wish I would have let off with that, because the way everything came together with the World's Fair's focus on science and technology, we've done big things. We will continue to do big things. You know, to the layman's terms of that, the message coming out of that World's Fair. FDR is the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Even his campaign song was Sunny Days Are...
Happy Days Are Here Again.
Happy Days Are Here Again. So it really did kind of bring everything together of what we once... I wasn't around then, so I can't even imagine what we could be as a nation, the promise of that we, in a lot of ways, haven't really lived up to, but the idea of hope and going forward.
Yeah, I mean, that was why the American people first started loving Roosevelt, because they got the feeling that he actually believed in them. You know, things are going to get better because you will make them better, and I will help you make them better. And so that, you know, that was what they needed to hear, you know, that if we're all in it together, we'll do fine.
It feels like we've gone so far from that. Do you see any, this is another big question, but could there be an event like an All-Star game again that could just kind of bring everyone together?
I'd love to believe it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm afraid, but we'll need something apocalyptic like the Depression to initiate it, I'm afraid.
That's true. Something sometimes bottoming me out, but unfortunately a lot of people get hurt in that process. I mean, you talk about in the book, people, you know, the breadlines, of course, everyone knows, farms being abandoned and everything like that. Chicago had a very high poverty rate at the time, too, especially on the south side of the city where the event was being held.
Yeah.
So it really was an amazing thing that it came together at the right time, and things didn't really get better right away after that. But the sense of hope was restored following the stock market's crash.
Yeah. Well, I mean, among other things, that World's Fair probably did more to promote integration than any other event in Chicago up to that point, because they decided to do that's the French. But yes, they decided to do that exhibit. It was a group of black women who pushed for it. You know, they got no help from the city's alleged black leaders, but this group of women pushed and pushed and pushed, and they finally said, okay, we'll do a replica log cabin. But there was a lot of concern about what it'll be like with these crowds mixing, and it turned out that there was no problem.
Yeah, it's wonderful what people could do when they come together without outside influence.
Yeah.
Of people trying to predict what human nature might be, when at the end of the day, a lot of us, more of us want to get along than don't. I've found, I hope at least, and this book really highlighted a lot of that. Like, you know, as a Wrigley Field tour guide, one of my things that I'm most proud to let people know is that Wrigley Field's largest regular season crowd was Jackie Robinson's 1947 debut.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we had capacity then was like 37,000, 38,000 people in between that, and we had 48,000 people, 10,000 standing room only. But in typical Chicago fashion, that number was only reported at 45,000, because any one person over that was hefty fines from the fire department. So, of course, there was some fibbing involved, which, you know, in some things, it's all right a little bit. It's a little Chicago wink, I like to call it. But another thing that, while you were doing the research for this book, I really feel like right now, and maybe it's because we're a little too connected with 24-hour news networks and social media, it feels like every week Americans get a sense, are we living just, every week there's gonna be a new world event that we're living through. It feels like we're watching major historical events unfold constantly nowadays. Did you, through your research, get the vibe, I should say, that the people who were living, the major figures of that era, did they feel like they were living through a time in which everything that was happening was going to be remembered long after?
Well, in the Depression, they were living through a time where they felt like it was all falling apart and there might not be a country left. So, I think it was so much in the moment. America was so young. Newspapers were the mass media. I mean, that's the one thing that I really love about that time is that, because I started as a newspaper man when I was in my early 20s. And, I just love that, I think Chicago had like 15 dailies or something.
Quite a few.
Yeah. And, but people weren't inundated with, and everybody screaming for clicks by presenting the most, I mean, there were screaming headlines, but that's not quite the same.
It's not quite the same as the world we're living in now, where everything's clickbait and people use headlines to try to pull you in and everything like that. So yes, Chicago had, and there was two editions a day. I think a lot of people don't realize there was multiple editions a day, and everything was kind of catered around when would this news be made available to people. And if I could bring it back to baseball, the Cubs have the W flag tradition. When we win, we hoist a big white flag with a navy blue W on the top of the Wrigley Field scoreboard. And that was simply to tell the neighborhood that we won.
Yeah.
Because there was no evening news, and they played nothing but day baseball, so you didn't know if they won till the very next day. And so people taking the train would see the flag, hey, Cubs won, everyone would cheer. And that was kind of an exciting thing. And that's why newspapers had a first edition, a second edition. Major League Baseball had two All-Star games for a long time.
For a number of years.
Exactly. I mean, it wasn't decades.
It was a bad idea.
It wasn't,
I think.
Do you think it was a bad idea?
Well, it takes away from the All-Star game.
Very good point. I think selfishly I liked it because there are so many players who don't have a good first half.
That's true.
So then they get honored for their second half play.
That's true.
So that's a big part of that too. So yes, it was a different time back then, and Chicago, their newspapers are arrogant. A lot of them, the Chicago Tribune, after all, WGN Television stood for World's Greatest Newspaper.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a little bit of arrogance there. So I just always thought to myself that I think one of the things that's missing with how we view things in America today is that we do forget about history way too often.
Yeah, well, I really felt like I was kind of crusading for at least remembering this history and remembering those players, those people, because they really were creating a foundation. And, I was looking, I was thinking, ESPN came out with its list of the 100 greatest players. To bring up Al Simmons, I was thinking, he used to be considered the 12th greatest player of all time not that long ago, but now he's not even on the list of the top 100. And I was looking at, Bryce Harper at 94. Lifetime batting average of 270-something. Al Simmons hit lifetime batting average was 334, I think it was, and it was only that low because he played a lot of seasons when he was past his prime. And yet, somehow he's been, so it was a fight against what historians call chronocentrism, which is the idea that the time you're living in or whatever's closest to it is more important. And, I wanted to push back against that.
And I'm glad you did. I think there's too many different people nowadays just don't appreciate the past, especially in the world of sports. People are always saying, if Babe Ruth played today. But one of the nice things about baseball is we know how big these dimensions were on the ballpark. So if he hits a home run at Wrigley Field that goes over that 400-foot wall, we know, they do that now, and we know where the balls land.
Well, that is the beauty of baseball. I mean, it is, essentially the metrics are the same. They've changed some things, and I'm one of those people who doesn't appear. I think they should have kept everything pure, the way it, in terms of number of games, all of that, just so there's a fair basis for comparison.
Yes.
But still, I think that is what people still love about baseball is that it kind of harkens back to our earliest traditions, our sense of history and connection to a place.
Well, I am very grateful as a huge fan of the city of Chicago and a huge fan of the game of baseball and American politics and American history to have a book like this where all of them come together. And I do really enjoy the fact that, like you were saying, with a game like baseball and how, you keep certain things, like the asterisk, you know what I mean? People, we love the idea that this guy was great in this era. He should be respected across all eras, because it's always, to me, unfair that people will say, well, that guy didn't face today's pitching. Well, yeah. We don't know. Like, yeah. Also, though, they'll say, if you brought this athlete back 70 years ago, he would be the great.
Who cares?
Enjoy the moment that's in front of you. And also, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, the high-top shoe wasn't invented. There are so many things that are unfair. Like, Gale Sayers was a great NFL star for the Chicago Bears. Had he got the same injury that took him out in the 1960s, he'd be back 4 weeks later if he had it today. I mean, there's modern medicine. There's all sorts of great things in that regard. But, you know, you mentioned how Al Simmons is not even in the top 100 anymore?
No. Well, according to ESPN.
Well, you worked for Rolling Stone magazine, and they will change their 100 greatest guitarists, it feels like, every year.
Well, I worked for Rolling Stone when it was really great.
There we go. I like that answer. Thank you so much. By the way, this is going to conclude our time. You guys, if any of you, you know, the book signing is going to begin. I see your hand, sir. You'll be able to hopefully save it for that. I want to thank Allison. I want to thank Randall Sullivan, and I want to encourage all of you to get the book, check out his other works. And hopefully there's some more Chicago books to come, because I really appreciated your telling of our history. Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you're notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.